From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
They say there's no atheists in a foxhole. There's not many atheists when you're waiting to see if it's going to rain on your crops or not. You know, the lives we lead allow us to pretend that we can do without these deep things in our lives.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. That was Dominic Green, author of The Religious Revolution and Pulliam Fellow here on Hillsdale's campus for the spring term. We'll talk with him about writing, journalism, and religion a little bit later on in the program. First, we're joined by Dr. Matthew Young. He is Dean of Natural Sciences and Associate Professor of Chemistry at Hillsdale College. He is also your teacher for the brand new Hillsdale online course, The Great Principles of Chemistry, available now at online.hillsdale.edu. Dr. Young, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Pleasure to have you back. Excited about the new online course. What should people expect if they take The Great Principles of Chemistry?
Well, this class is it's meant to be a taste of the chemistry course that Hillsdale students take as part of the core curriculum. And so in that way, it's meant to give not a comprehensive, all of the facts of chemistry or all the chemistry you need to know to move on to other chemistry courses, but a taste for how chemistry helps us to understand the world. And so that's why we call it the Great Principles. Some of the central ideas of chemistry and how they help us understand the world. And I hope people can come away from the course with a renewed appreciation for chemistry, mm-hmm. a very large and beautiful subject. And also, in addition to these principles, I hope to show people how some of the important ideas in chemistry have come about historically, mm-hmm. How they were developed, when they were developed, some of that historical context.
We could spend a long time on this question, and I know you have many thoughts. But why should chemistry be studied alongside the liberal arts? Where is its position there?
Well, in some ways, I would even like to rephrase the question a little bit, because I wouldn't even think of it as studying chemistry alongside the liberal arts, but rather thinking of how can we think of chemistry as part of the liberal arts. Inasmuch as the liberal arts are those disciplines that help us to see the way things actually are, to apprehend reality, then I think chemistry has along with the other natural sciences, has an important role to play there. And so sometimes people like to think of the sciences and the liberal arts, mm-hmm. but I actually like to think of it as the sciences as part of the liberal arts in helping us understand what is true and what is real. And so I think what you will see in this course is that chemistry has an important contribution to make to that.
How can chemistry help us understand the world around us?
Well, there's scarcely an area of modern life that isn't impacted by chemistry. So all of the wide variety of materials that we use, whether it's in energy sources for heat or transportation or making electricity, whether it's food, materials for clothing, pharmaceutical compounds, you could go on and on. And so understanding the way the materials that we use every day work, I think is part of it. But I think that there's something more fundamental about why one would study chemistry. Because chemistry helps us to sort of see what the structure of matter is at a microscopic level that is very different from the level that we exist at, that we can see with our own unaided eyes and so forth. And so it helps us to see what matter's actually like at the microscopic, atomic, and molecular level. And then also, it's not just about structure. Chemistry is about studying change. Mm-hmm. How can material substances be transformed into other material substances? And so understanding those processes is what chemistry is all about.
Dr. Matthew Young with us. The new course, The Great Principles of Chemistry, available at online.hillsdale.edu. These great principles that you're introducing to people in the course, what are some of those basics of chemistry of which everyone should have an understanding.
Well, in the course, there's a couple of major ideas that I try to trace. One is the idea of the element. What are the kind of fundamental building blocks of matter? You know, that's the question of what is matter at its core. And so we trace the idea of the element from antiquity up through the development of the periodic table and into current times. And then another idea is the idea of the atom, related to the element, of course. And really, once we get the periodic table, we can't really understand what it's all about without understanding the structure of the atom. And so also, and this is also an old question of, are there atoms? What would they look like? But tracing the development of the idea of the atom is another important idea. Once we have those ideas in place, then we have what we need to understand how compounds can be made from the elements. And so the important ideas of chemistry are, how can elements bond together to form just a vast variety of compounds? One of the most amazing things about chemistry is the fact that there's only fewer than 100 stable elements, but yet the variety of materials that exist in the world is just totally vast.
Besides you, are we able to meet some other leading scientists along the way during the great principles of chemistry?
Well, I mentioned that I like to focus on some of the historical context of the development of ideas. So some of the big players in this story are Antoine Lavoisier, a French chemist who was a very skilled experimentalist, established the law of conservation of mass, explained the role of oxygen in combustion, and really set chemistry on a theoretical foundation that established it as a modern natural science. And so he's often thought of as the father of modern chemistry. I talked about atoms. We'll also look at John Dalton, who used empirical laws from Lavoisier and others to come up with the first modern atomic theory, which then kicks off really understanding what atoms are. Now, when we think about what atoms are, we really need to go to physicists such as Thomson and Rutherford and Niels Bohr to get a handle on what atoms really are like. We'll talk about Dmitry Mendeleev and the development of the periodic table. We'll also talk about Gilbert Lewis, who is the namesake behind the famous Lewis structures that most people have drawn in their high school chemistry courses. But he used intuition about nature to come up with the idea of the covalent bond and really understand the way in which nonmetals can bond to each other by sharing electrons, not by transferring electrons from a metal to a nonmetal.
So here's the big question. Are you able to bring us into the lab and show us some experiments to illustrate these things that you're teaching?
Yeah, well, one of the great things about teaching chemistry is that you can not only just describe what's happening or describe some kind of abstract concept, but in many cases, you can actually show it happening right there, right? And I think we could distinguish between two ways you can do this. One is we call them demos, where in the front of the class, we might show something happening. And then the other is experimental labs, where the students are doing hands-on labs. They're in the lab working on experiments in pairs or independently. So getting in the lab and doing hands-on work is not going to be part of this course. But we will do some demos where I can illustrate.
It's good enough.
Yeah, illustrate what's
happening.
Don't
try this at home, but we'll do it for you in the online course, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
What about limitations? I think it's the final class in this online course, The Great Principles of Chemistry, talks a little about some of the natural limitations about the discipline of chemistry.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess first I might say that I think I like to think of the natural sciences as a whole as being an intentionally self-limiting enterprise, that understand that there are a subset of questions that are very well suited to being answered by the natural sciences. And there are other questions that are very poorly suited to being answered. And so questions like, about meaning and beauty and things like that, and ultimate purpose, are just not really the domain of the natural sciences. Now, chemistry in particular, one of the limitations is that I don't think when we learn a lot of chemistry, then sometimes we can get excited and think that, maybe chemistry could explain everything that goes on in biology, for example. And there's been a lot of, I wouldn't say encroachment, but chemistry has provided a lot of support to biology as we understand more and more about the molecular mechanisms of life processes. However, I think it's not true that biology can be fully reduced to chemistry. And so chemistry is limited in what it can explain. And actually, we need biology to explain what goes on in living systems and populations of living systems and so forth. And this is also true as we move sort of up this chain of reductionism, you might say, into sociology and psychology mm-hmm. and so forth, and into the humanities. And so I think chemistry is a really important window into reality, but I don't think we want to say that chemistry can explain all complex phenomena or that everything could be reduced ultimately to chemistry.
Final question for Dr. Matthew Young. He's your teacher for the new online course, The Great Principles of Chemistry, now at online.hillsdale.edu. Are there some big questions in chemistry out there that we're still trying to answer? What do we know that we don't know quite yet?
Well, I nothing really jumps out at me as a big theoretical question that chemistry is working on solving right now. But chemistry is about materials. And so although I've been focusing a lot on this idea of fundamental understanding about the way things work, we also should remember that a lot of what chemists are actually up to is making new materials. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes people think that chemistry doesn't have a lot going on because it doesn't have like a big unanswered theoretical problem hanging over it. But actually, chemistry is it's the most active discipline in the sciences, in the sense that the majority, the largest number of papers published each year are in chemistry. And that's just because chemistry is making new materials all the time. And so there's always lots more to discover, because as you make new materials, then you need to characterize their properties and you can think about what they might be actually useful for. Mm-hmm. And so, actually, as chemistry progresses in terms of its role in making new materials, chemistry creates more questions than it creates, faster than it creates answers in some ways. And in that way, it's a unlimited enterprise that will always have plenty of new discoveries to make.
Check out the online course, The Great Principles of Chemistry. Your teacher is Dr. Matthew Young. He's Dean of Natural Sciences and Associate Professor of Chemistry at Hillsdale College. online.hillsdale.edu for the new online course. Dr. Young, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My pleasure.
Up next, we hear from Dominic Green. He's the author of The Religious Revolution, also our Pulliam Fellow in the spring here at Hillsdale College. We'll talk journalism, religion, and more next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Coming soon on The Larry Arnn Show, psychiatrist, writer, and literary scholar Ian McGilchrist.
Beautiful works of art speak to us if we listen to them. That means not rushing in with our preconceptions, but attending honorably to them. And if we do, that attention is a beautiful thing, because it will then speak to you and you learn something. But if you go to it with your preconceived ideas about what's true, you're not even getting an education, and you're depriving yourself of the experience of actually encountering this poem, or whatever it may be.
Don't miss this conversation between Ian McGilchrist and Hillsdale College President Larry Arnn. Subscribe now to The Larry Arnn Show at podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Dominic Green. He is a writer. You've seen him in many places. His most recent book is The Religious Revolution, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898. He's here on Hillsdale's campus, our Pulliam Fellow in this spring term. He'll lecture on some themes from that book here on Hillsdale's campus. Dominic, thanks so much for joining us.
Scott, thank you.
Happy to have you here in studio. You've got a very interesting background. I want to talk about the book and journalism, but I would be remiss if not asking you about your background as a musician. If you follow your Twitter feed at all, which is at Dr. Dominic Green, Dr. Dominic Green, you write so well about music. There's a really neat essay you wrote recently on Brian Johnson's memoir from AC/DC over at the Free Beacon. What's your background as a musician? How do you balance playing music and writing?
Oh, well, thank you. I come from a family of musicians. My grandfather volunteered in the First World War for the winning side. And when they were rotated out of the trenches, they were given as entertainment. They got to hear the Harlem Hellfighters, I believe they were called, the first American jazz orchestra, black mm-hmm. orchestra from New York. And he figured that if he survived, he would play that sort of music. And he did, and he bought a clarinet with his D-mob money, you know. And there were a few other people who'd come to similar conclusions. And the result was that my grandfather, my father, my brother, and I all became jazz musicians in Britain. And it's a small world. And it's also a dynastic world. You know, we hear a lot about Nepo babies. But there's not much nepo to be had, not much nepotism, really, in the mm-hmm. sense that the gains are very small, but it's a wonderful thing to do. And so I worked as a jazz guitar player from the age of 14, I think I started earning. But I also knew I wanted to be a writer, and I became the first person in my family to complete the equivalent of a high school diploma, and then went to university. And then embarked on a musician's career. And by my late 20s, early 30s, I was, like most sportsmen, starting to feel it in my knees, wondering how much longer I could keep going at that pace. And so I started writing. But I still think of myself in many ways as a musician. Mm-hmm. And really, there's not too much difference between the gigging mentality of yeah. a musician and the freelancing mentality of a writer, in that you're permanently auditioning, you're permanently working with different groups and different people, and that's part of the fun of it, actually.
How do you go from musician to writer to becoming interested in these questions you explore in The Religious Revolution, these questions of religion and changes, specifically during the 19th century?
Well, if you grow up in Britain, you're very much in the shadow of the 19th century. You know, I live now in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is like being in a museum of the 18th century in many ways. I can't leave the house without people making jokes at me about the American Revolution when they hear my accent. So there is that. I came from, I would say, a sort of, in England, we would be called showbiz Jews. So religion to me was always an interesting subject. And the more I practiced it, the more interested I became in it. And the more I also realized as I studied academically that religion was understood, and religious feelings in the broad sense, you know, what we now have come to call spirituality, this was really underrated as a force that makes people do things. You know, we live in a world of that believes itself to be completely rational. Mm-hmm. We aspire to have rational systems of government and society, even technocracy, as we call it, which is pure rationalism in government. But of course, all of us know in our daily lives, we're all deeply irrational, emotional people. So when it came, when I came to the United States nearly 20 years ago, it was clear to me that some kind of radical change had occurred in the way things were done, and not for the first time in American society. Mm-hmm. And you could see it in my own people, the Jews, and you could see it all around, that there was, and you could see it in the weakening of religious institutions in general. And you could see, not unrelated, a crisis of authority and a crisis of purpose in American society. And of course, that's only deepened in the 20 years I've been here.
Yeah. In this era that you talk about in the book, 1848, 1898, you're in the wake of the Enlightenment, there is a lot of upheaval and challenges to religion. What is happening to sort of push the established Christianity
to the side in some places, or at least cause people to ask questions and change their behaviors?
In a word, technology. It's technology that brings people into cities. And simply living in a city is proven to be quite bad for your religion if you're Christian. In the 18th century, when London became the biggest city in the world, the Church of England ministers were saying, what is happening to our congregations? Why aren't they turning up anymore?
Mm-hmm.
So technology makes for urbanization. It also connects people and creates new types of community across spaces. So again, it attacks the very notion of a single religious community. You're simultaneously, and we all have this experience now being online, part of multiple communities. And technology also means that you can send these religious ideas across vast areas.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're sending information, it hits people the same way. I think this is something which has become clear in the last few years, in case anyone ever doubted it, that politics is the substitute for religion. You know, keeping busy generally might be a substitute. You know,
yes.
The workaholic is very often trying to fill a similar void and need. But it's in the 19th century that our way of doing this really cohered, that people even started talking about spirituality, and also that the substitutes sort of appeared. The idea of self-help is a creation of the 1850s. Environmentalism is a 19th century idea. What we now call wokeness is absolutely a 19th century idea, the New Age, as they called it then. And this book, obviously, I started writing it before I'd really heard of wokeness or Black Lives Matter or critical race theory. But I'd realized that this was all going on around us. And it has very, very deep roots, and I think it can be traced back to the weakening of Christian authority.
So you talk about this longing that doesn't go away, the trying to find a meaning for our existence, trying to find what it's all about. Why do people then and now feel more comfortable about pouring themselves into these other vessels, but not necessarily into religion?
Well, there are two or three reasons I can think of. One is that it looks easier. It looks easier to go to work, turn up, do a few hours and go home and have a purpose that way, mm-hmm. than to examine yourself and put yourself onto a lifelong course of basically self-improvement. The second is closely related to that. Once you start doing that, then your understanding of yourself is going to be changed often in quite critical ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's among Jews, the phrase, the yoke of the Torah is the literal, that's the metaphor. You're literally taking up a burden, you know. And most people would rather put one down than take one up. That's also a universal human impulse.
Yeah.
So I think it has a lot to do with that convenience, difficulty, that the best things require a bit of effort. And the nature of our societies has tended towards automation, making things more convenient rather than less. They say there's no atheists in a foxhole. There's not many atheists when you're waiting to see if it's going to rain on your crops or not. You know, the lives we lead allow us to pretend that we can do without these deep things in our lives.
Dominic Green with us. The Religious Revolution is his book, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898. I want to ask about that phrase, modern spirituality, because these days, certainly, and perhaps even back then, people will say, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. What do they mean by that?
There's a lot of debate on this. The last major survey in the U.S. was in 2017. And that produced the number of 27% of Americans saying this. And it was up 5%, up from 19% in 2012. So it's quite a sharp rise. And I imagine if they asked now, they would get a similar rise. To the best of my endeavors, nobody had ever said anything like that until the middle of the 19th century. The point that I identify as an early tremor is when Emerson changes job, effectively. Instead of becoming a Unitarian minister, he becomes a freelance lecturer and effectively starts to see Christianity as one religion among many. He's basically doing what we would now call comparative religion. But it becomes a mass phenomenon. in the later part of the 19th century, so that people are actually talking about the New Age. You have mass movements in, say, religion and politics, socialism, feminism. These are all part of that shift. This is a reorganization of society. And I think before the 1840s, and I think the first person to actually say it is French. Funnily enough, the first person to say modernity is also French in the 1840s. The first person to say spiritualité is in Paris, I believe it's Baudelaire, perhaps. And they're talking about art, not talking about politics, real life, as it were. Talking about art in the way that we would very soon understand as the religion of art, which is perhaps the most obvious substitute for religion.
I was talking with Spencer Clavin about his brand new book, How to Save the West, and he has a chapter on the crisis of religion. And he wrote, and you've alluded to this a little bit, that in our actions, if not in our words, we show we still have these beliefs. Does that give you, I don't know if hope is the right word, does that convince you that there is something inside of us that will perhaps slide back toward a more religious life?
Yes, I think one of the discoveries of the 18th and 19th centuries was that societies develop in a cyclical manner. And that if you're disintegrating, then you've got a pretty good chance of also reintegrating. I think there is a lot of truth in the argument that some scientists make, that there are very strong practical reasons why religiosity, the ability to see transcendent purpose despite the day-to-day, the ability to form communities and hold together, through adversity, why religiosity has genuine practical value for societies or for individuals and, of course, for families. There's even the sociologists who have offered a great substitute in a way, mm-hmm. and tried to organize us along different lines, even the sociologists have to admit that there are such obvious benefits that, you know, as things go sour, people will see the practical advantage. And I think that is true.
Talking with Dominic Green, The Religious Revolution is his book, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898. Also on campus here at Hillsdale College as our Pulliam Fellow for this spring term in 2023 and delivering a lecture here while you're on campus. You mentioned Emerson, you talk about Thoreau in the book. Who are some of the other people that are players in this scene of the birth of modern spirituality?
Well, heretically, at least among historians, I identify Karl Marx as a key figure. I think if you, it's simply a matter of looking at the archival material. You know, there's an archive in Amsterdam, which is the sort of World Socialist Archive, and they have all these letters from the early socialists to each other. And they're all saying, we need to think of something which will fill the gap which has been left after Christianity, after the French Revolution. The modern science of society will be the alternative religion. Mm-hmm. And it's only gradually via Engels and then via Lenin that socialism becomes a matter of industrial production and economics. So Karl Marx is in there. Of course, the transcendentalists, the French poets like Baudelaire, but also there's people like Darwin. The debate over evolutionary theory all about God, the purpose of humans. If they're in a godless universe, what are they here for? Mm-hmm. And Darwin's friends and colleagues are sending him letters saying, you've got to say something. And because this question of the nature of what it is to be human becomes entangled in the 19th century with new theories about race, people are also sending letters to Darwin saying, what kind of soul do you have depending on what kind of race you're in? And Darwin is strongly influenced by this when he writes The Descent of Man. I talk about Richard Wagner, who is perhaps unacknowledged as a socialist revolutionary. He certainly understood himself as one. I talk about Helena Blavatsky, mm-hmm. who is the great popularizer of the New Age, of global religions. Most of the things that were heavily commercialized in the 60s began in the 1860s, really, with Blavatsky. I talk a lot about Nietzsche, who is the philosopher who is probably the most accurate analysis of the breakdown of Christianity in Europe and what it's going to mean, and understands also the dangers of socialism as a substitute. And I end on a pair of figures. One of them is Theodor Herzl, who's considered the founder of modern Zionism. And the other is Swami Vivekananda, who's the founder of Hindu nationalism. And so one of the themes that I follow is, because the 19th century was the first age of globalization, and we are now, I believe, seeing the close of the second, these ideas were globalized. They influenced people, and their effect was to revive two religious civilizations as political ones. And of course, the creation of modern Israel and India are each in their ways astonishing geopolitical developments mm-hmm. that come out of the 20th century and will continue to shape events in the 21st. So I used this idea of spirituality as a thread that you can really write a sort of new history of the world in a way. So it took a while.
I can imagine. Before we let you go, Dominic Green, I'll just change subjects a little here as we close. And you are published in many places. You write for a lot of outlets. As you sort of scan the state of journalism today, both here and abroad, perhaps, what are your thoughts? What are your big takeaways? Are we in a journalistic crisis in places here today?
I think we are, because journalism is usually, when it's done right, holding up a mirror to what's going on around it. But also, as with society, as with religion, I think that there are good grounds for optimism. I've been talking to these wonderful students here, and one thing I keep telling them is, remember that you are operating in a business, and in a technological business in particular. Mm-hmm. And as the technology has changed, the nature of communication has changed, from printing on a tablet with cuneiform to the printing press to the internet. All of these produced very different kinds of journalistic communication. Mm-hmm. We're now, in the last couple of years even, seeing the development of grassroots, independent, and actually capable of earning a living ways of doing journalism. In other words, we've worked our way back to the early 18th century, when you could print a sheet, distribute it in a coffee house to your friends.
Yeah.
You can post something on Substack. You can even convince your friends to pay a few dollars a month. And that model, I believe, is genuine. It puts people in contact with each other, and it doesn't force people to compromise. There's no advertisers, there's no political pressure, and of course, mainstream old-fashioned journalism is in an absolute crisis because of those two things. The advertisers have left it, and the political pressure is welcomed in mm-hmm. a way. That was what surprised me. And it goes the same in Britain as in America. The political pressure is accepted because it's a safe harbor. It gives the press a purpose to be spokesman, to release press releases, in effect, which is the opposite of what they're meant to be doing.
Right, right.
But it's a job. It's a living. So we're in this period of transition. Everything is up for grabs, and therefore it's worth fighting for doing it right, for being honest, authentic, and doing what you believe in. So I'm pretty optimistic. I think these students, I was saying this a couple of days ago, I said in you know, 10, 20 years' time, you'll be into this very different era of journalism. And if you do it right, it'll work. It'll be good.
Dominic Green is here on Hillsdale's campus, our Pulliam Fellow for spring of 2023. And his book is The Religious Revolution, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898. Dominic, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Scott, thank you.
Up next, we check in with Garrett West. He's a 2015 graduate of Hillsdale College and a former clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Coming soon on The Larry Arnn Show, psychiatrist, writer, and literary scholar Ian McGilchrist.
You are such an interesting man, living off on an island off Scotland, but I think that your books amount to a campaign to make us use the rest of our brain.
It's very interesting, because of course I would never think of them as like that, and they're not intended in that way. I am, I suppose, pleased, but I'm very accepting of whatever happens. Generally, I think it's a sensible way to look at life. But I have been noticing that more and more people in more and more areas are referring to my work and finding it relevant. And I'm very pleased by that, as by the response of readers, which is endlessly touching.
Don't miss this conversation between Ian McGilchrist and Hillsdale College President Larry Arn. Subscribe now to The Larry Arn Show at podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're joined now by Garrett West. He is a lawyer in Washington, D.C., a 2015 graduate of Hillsdale College, and a former clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court. Garrett, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Garrett, you clerked on the court for the October 2021 term, so part of 2021, part of 2022. Tell our listeners, what does that mean? What does it mean to clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court? What are your duties?
Well, the Supreme Court justices, like many other federal judges, have four law clerks who assist them in deciding cases. And the basic responsibilities of a clerk include the briefs come in for a particular case, and we read the briefs. We write a memo to the justice about, you know, how we think the case should be resolved. And then we answer any research questions that he or she might have based on that memo. Basically, our job is just to assist them in resolving cases, making up their own minds, and then deciding, writing the opinion if they are in charge of writing the opinion.
I'm sure it is a coveted position, and there are many, many applicants for the Supreme Court clerk positions. How did you end up with one of them? What was the application process like?
Well, it was a lot of luck, I would say. Basically, to end up clerking at the Supreme Court, you have to have done a prior clerkship in one of the other federal courts. And usually it's the case that one's former judge makes recommendations to the justices. So in my case, I clerked twice before right after I graduated from law school. I clerked on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which is an intermediate court that covers most of the West Coast, including California and Oregon, where I was living. And then I clerked for the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Both of my judges recommended me to work for Justice Alito.
So tell us a little bit about what's a typical day like as a Supreme Court clerk? What are the kind of things that you saw and did during your time there?
Well, it depends a lot on what is going on at the court at the time. If it is a day in which the court is hearing oral arguments, then usually you go to the oral arguments. You see the advocates present their case, and then usually the justice would come back from conference where all of the justices meet after arguments and say what happened, say what the justice decided on. So those are really the most exciting days and the day that you're working towards throughout the term. There are also a lot of days where you're just sitting alone in your office, reading briefs or writing memos to the justice. And those days are a little less interesting, but that's really where you get most of the work done. In between those two extremes, there are a lot of days where you're chatting with your co-clerks. So I had three clerks who worked for Justice Alito with me. And then there are lots of other clerks in the building for the other justices. So a lot of your time is spent walking around, chatting with the clerks about what they think about the cases, just so you can refine your own ideas while you're writing your recommendation to your boss.
Did you enjoy getting to know the justices a little bit better, specifically Justice Alito, of course? Are they essentially the kind of people that you expected them to be?
I had heard when I was applying for the clerkship that Justice Alito is one of the kindest bosses ever, and it was absolutely true. I remember when I went into interview, I didn't know I was going to get the job, but I thought to myself, well, at the very least, I'll get to spend 30 minutes chatting with Justice Alito. And over and over again throughout the term, I was just so impressed by how kind he is, how brilliant he is, how hard he works to get his cases right. And that was one of the greatest honors of the term, was to get to know him better and to work closely with him. The other justices clerks don't have as much interaction with them. One good practice of the court is that a lot of the times the clerks for other justices will go have lunch with those other justices throughout the term. So we did have lunch with the other justices, but really I was working closely with Justice Alito only.
Every term on the U.S. Supreme Court is tense and fraught with important opinions and decisions. The term you were there, especially so. Did you feel that pressure inside the court? Is it a palpable thing as they're discussing and trying to determine the fate of these cases?
Well, I think one thing that's hard about the job, a reason why it's difficult, is because a lot of the cases are so important. And it's true of, you know, every legal case going up through all of the courts in the United States. But at the Supreme Court, a lot of the times, they seem particularly momentous, and it will have a lot of impact on a lot of people. So there's a lot of pressure to get it right, to really work hard, to understand the law, and make the right recommendations. So I would say that makes the job more difficult than just the long hours. And there are long hours.
When you look back, perhaps not right now, but a few years from now, what do you think that you'll remember being your contributions to the operation of the court?
The thing I'm most proud of is just showing up every day and trying to make my boss's job easier. He's got to make a lot of decisions. He has to do a ton of work, write a lot of opinions. And, I'm just proud that I was able to help him get stuff out the door throughout the term.
Talking with Garrett West. He's a 2015 graduate of Hillsdale College and also spent some time as a clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court. How do you think that Hillsdale helped prepare you, first of all, for the experience you had at law school?
I mean, Hillsdale is a fantastic educational experience for anybody who's thinking about law school. And the reason is that you spend a lot of time reading very difficult texts, really difficult books, and also a lot of the times they're really boring. And that's a lot of the practice of law, is trying to understand what a statute means or what a judicial opinion means, and really taking the time to understand the arguments. There's also a lot of writing, and Hillsdale does a great job of teaching people to write clearly and logically about those really difficult texts that they're reading. And so, yeah, it was fantastic preparation. I was a philosophy major. I think anything where you do a lot of reading, a lot of writing, is really good practice for law. Also, anything where you have to speak extemporaneously is helpful. I didn't do as much as that, but fortunately, I'm able to mostly, I do a lot of reading and writing anyway, so it's okay.
Are there any particular lessons learned here at Hillsdale that you reflected on or thought of during your time as clerk, or now during your time as a lawyer in Washington, D.C.?
I think one thing I learned about at Hillsdale is that there's just really no excuse. There are no shortcuts. You really just have to sit down and go to class and do the reading, and that's how you learn things. And the same is true in law school, and the same is true practicing law. There's no shortcut to just sitting down and doing the work and doing the reading that's been assigned, and trying to understand what you're supposed to know about so that you can write about it well. And I think I took those lessons with me to law school and then to the practice of law.
Have you noticed perhaps any differences between your approach to the law or your approach to your work compared with others in your profession, in your field, who are not Hillsdale graduates?
Yes, I would. I think it really goes back to what I said about the preparation that Hillsdale gives. You know, I know a lot of really, really smart people that didn't have what I would think of as the kind of education that you ought to get when you go off to college. They don't have as much experience reading really hard and foreign texts, and they don't know as much about the Western tradition and so on and so forth. I think that can be really helpful to understand the development of the law, which can be helpful even to understanding the law as it is today. And so I do think that is an edge that Hillsdale graduates have in the practice of law.
Final question for Garrett West. What perhaps is one thing that we all should know about the Supreme Court, how it works, that we don't, that you may have picked up from your time working as a clerk?
It's a wonderfully deliberative body. There's a lot of debate and disagreement going on behind the scenes among the justices and also among the clerks. A lot of work, a lot of thinking goes into any opinion that goes out the door, and not all of that is released. Not all of that is directly included in the opinion, but everyone can be very sure that every single time the Supreme Court issues a decision, there have been tons and tons and tons of hours put into making sure that the decision is right.
Garrett West, 2015 graduate of Hillsdale College, also a Supreme Court clerk in the October 2021 term and currently a lawyer in Washington, D.C. Garrett, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Matthew Young from Hillsdale's Chemistry Department. Journalist Dominic Green joined the show, and Garrett West, a 2015 graduate of Hillsdale and a former Supreme Court clerk. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews here or listen anytime to the podcast. The assistant producer of the program is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.